Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, Julie Meddy Bennett from Public Sector Consultants and Matt Resch from Resch Strategies share their takeaways from the first 6 months of the first Democratic-led state government in 40 years. Nick Acapinti of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters addresses why renewable portfolio standards need to be stricter when the dirty air we've all been breathing in lately is from wildfires in Canada. And Michigan Legislative Consultants President Tim Ward embarks on an epic adventure to raise awareness for a program designed to bring more harmony to Michigan prisons. Now, here's MERS editor Kyle Malin and reporter Samantha Schreiber.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. Well, we're tying a bow on the first half of the 2023 legislative session, and joining me to talk about it is Julie Meddy Bennett from Public Sector Consultants and Matt Resch from Resch Strategies. Thank you guys both for joining us here on the podcast. A lot of things to talk about, but let's start out with most memorable moments. What stood out to you, Julie, in this first legislative session?
I'd have to say the hyper-speed pace of Democrats getting bills to the governor's desk. It's really been, eyebrow-raising. I think I read that the Michigan House passed more bills in the month of January than during January's and the last six sessions combined. So that hyper-speed pace. Also, it felt like I was watching the Snyder administration in reverse order, you know, with the ditching of the right-to-work law, the revived prevailing wage for state construction projects, the low-income tax credit, the pension tax, just unraveling of all that was done. And you hear a lot of union priorities in that list as well. So I think that's also worth mentioning, that there's been this shift from business interests really dominating decisions in Lansing like we've seen for decades to more working class issues.
Matt, this is the first time the Democrats have had control of the House, the Senate, and the governor's office for 40 years. It felt like it, didn't it?
It did. And you know what was remarkable? And I can't think of a single moment to your question, but to follow up on what Julie said, what was remarkable to me was, having worked in the legislature for a number of years, while a number of those things and those reforms that Julie mentioned had passed originally, how hard they were to get done. And some of them took many sessions to get done. It wasn't like just a quick vote, hey, let's get done and move on to the next big, huge thing we're going to do. And how quickly it all just unraveled. It was, yeah. I mean, some of those things took 40 years to get in place. And in the course of 4 months, it's all gone. And that is a dramatic realization for me as someone who was on the floor of the House for when some of those things passed, as worked in Governor Engler's office when some of that stuff was passed. To see just how quickly and how disciplined the Democrats were. I mean, they have no margins. And a lot of those years that those reforms were passed in the past, Republicans had large majorities, had 10 seat majorities and couldn't get things passed. And with two seats, how easily and how disciplined the Dems were in getting that stuff done.
So this kind of segues into my next question. I think I know what the answer is going to be, Matt, but who did it better? Did the Democrats adjust better to being in the majority, or did the Republicans adjust better to being in the minority?
Well, I think the Dems did for sure, but they had the easier task. You know, they had the to-do list. They had the 40-year list of, you know, every interest group of their party was there at the front step in mid-November. Like, here's your list. You know, we've been waiting. Go do this. Go do this. Go do this. So it didn't take a lot of thought on their part. I mean, it was like, here are the things we're going to go check off. And, I think the Republicans were handicapped. I mean, both parties were handicapped in the fact that we need to remember there was a huge turnover in talent and in membership. I mean, it wasn't just a turnover in party control, but there was a massive turnover in new members. And so not only were the Republicans out of practice in how to be in the minority, a lot of the Republicans just didn't know what to do in the first place about being a legislator. And having worked with some of them, I could sense in them the struggle. Like they knew they should be doing something. They didn't know exactly what to do or how to say it, and they'd never said it before. Like they had never given a speech in committee or get on the House floor in the first place, let alone in a very contentious issue. So I think, you know, the Dems had some natural advantages because their agenda had been set for them on day one. And they had some good people. They had some good talent around them that could kind of guide the ship at the top.
I've heard that behind the scenes, Julie, that there was some consternation among the Democrats, some internal tension that you would expect. But, it's hard to argue that they weren't effective because of all the stuff that they got done. Do you think they did better transitioning to the majority than the Republicans did adjusting in the minority?
I have to start with saying I wrestle with these questions of who's winning the horse race. I like to focus on public policy and not politics, but I agree with Matt that I think the Democrats did establish their sea legs really quickly, and especially after not being in the majority for so long. You know, they had the list and they got it done, and I think they had good control over what went up for votes. They seemed comfortable positioning decisions when postponing decisions when they didn't have the votes, and they looked really united. I felt like they were working out their differences among themselves, and there hasn't really been any mudslinging in the public. So I'd agree with Matt that if I have to choose a horse, I'd choose the Democrats.
It seems like their biggest problem was getting everybody to show up.
Yeah.
If they got everyone to be there, they could. I mean, I was working on a couple issues where, like, we thought, okay, well, we're going to get screwed today. We're going to get screwed today. But then they didn't have the right people didn't show up, and they didn't have enough people to pass the stuff. Attendance seemed to be their biggest challenge.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned party unity and discipline. And when you don't have any margin for error, it's amazing how it creates that bond among members. I think that's what you saw. And Matt, you have experience on this. The more members you have, you think it's easier to pass. But what happens is that there's members who feel like they can go ahead and go it on their own because their buddy next to them in the caucus will take care of it.
Absolutely. I mean, when you have a cushion, you know, every caucus has their vulnerable members, the members they have to protect from tough votes. They don't have a cushion. They can't protect anybody. Everybody's on the same team. Everybody has to vote because they can't give anybody up. But if you have 6, 7, 8 seats, then, you know, a couple of those guys and members can just say, you know, I'm just going to sit this one out because you don't need me to do this. And then it becomes a real challenge because then, you know, you're looking around across the aisle and seeing, well, why does that guy get to not vote on this time? And so I think, yeah, having such a slim majority, I think really, really brought them together.
Do you anticipate the same level of party discipline going forward, Julie? Do you think we're going to continue to see this, or do you think we're going to see more bipartisanship?
Well, I'm going to be optimistic, and I'm going to hope for more bipartisanship. I mean, will partisan politics rule the day? Of course it will. But you see things like the Growing Michigan Together Council that actually just kicked off. I think there'll be a press release on it. Later today, we convened our first meeting, and that's a bipartisan effort to really focus on the state's economic health and our quality of life and trying to grow and attract the people that live here. So I'm going to stay optimistic and hope that we see more bipartisanship moving forward.
One of the things that got some bipartisanship, but not a lot, was this budget that passed a record $81.7 billion, and it was wrapped into a supplemental. So when you add everything together, that was $87 billion in funding that was put through in essentially 7 hours from its unveiling to its final passage. Now, Julie, you could argue that that is efficiency right there, that they're able to put that together, or you could argue that that is just proof that this is all done behind closed doors, that this is just a scripted deal, and it wasn't it wasn't properly vetted. What would you argue on this?
Well, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of back and forth within the majority caucuses, and just because it wasn't played out in the public, I don't see that as being any different than what happened under the Snyder administration. I did, you know, notice more harmony than in past sessions, but when we've had divided government because, you know, the governor and the legislature are operating across the same party lines, more conversations take place where they're working out disagreements among themselves, or in the past, you know, you always see legislators leaving meetings with the governor clearly unhappy or downright mad and communicating that to the media. I don't know where that animosity really gets us, but I think, you know, that's the big difference. Also, you know, Democrats have the luxury of being able to right-size things more easily if they don't get it, you know, perfect in the budget process through supplementals and other means. So I think that's leads to what you saw with the efficiency, was having that united government.
Matt, you and I have been on the House floor back in the aughts with Craig DeRoche, and we saw that these budgets played out over multiple days. We had different conference committees and things stretched out for an entire week. And we've moved now to, you know, a budget day, and now we've moved to a budget afternoon. How has this happened?
Well, you know, the omnibus process has really changed the whole thing. I mean, it didn't used to be that they just dumped everything into one bill. There used to be 15, 16 different budget bills, and today we're going to do ag. Today we're going to do the attorney general. Today we're going to do, you know, health and human services. Now it's all one massive 1,600-page thing that has the number of mistakes and things that people will pass next year's budget and still be finding mistakes that have to be fixed in this year's budget. I'm sure you just can't do it this way. But I think, to Julie's point about the harmony, I think while it's not easier to pass a budget when you've got a ton of money, it's less acrimonious. I mean, they weren't arguing about what things to cut. They were arguing about which pork project, you know, who gets this, who gets that. They were divvying up a huge pot of money. Now, you can argue they spent it all, and maybe next year we're going to have some troubles. But it's easier to fight about spending a ton than it is about cutting stuff. And a lot of those years that, you know, Kyle and I were there, you know, we were cutting, and they were decisions about, you know, how we have to cut the budget, not spend.
And that's a lot different of a conversation, but it's also something else to see the transparency in what's actually in the budget kind of decrease. I mean, we're going to be looking through this budget for weeks and months and still not knowing everything that's in it. And I hate to say that. I hate to just be trite and say this was a transformational budget, which seems like a talking point, but it really is, because this budget is so different from budgets in the past, which have been, oh, this is just kind of a continuation budget. We're going to do kind of the same thing we did last year, except a couple of programs here and there, or we got to do some cuts, and you know, there's not going to be any money increase really for universities or revenue sharing. I mean, we've heard this so many times, but this budget had so many different programs, so many new things that they were doing, that it's going to take some time to really, I think, really fully appreciate it, Julie.
No, I totally agree. It is, there is a lot in there. There's a lot of priorities. And I agree with Matt that when you are in a scarcity mode, it can be a lot more confrontational. And this is more of an abundance mode. But what I think that you saw in the budget was a reflection of the governor's priorities and funding the governor's priorities, specifically education. So much investment in education. And so, you know, it was an efficient, quick process with a lot of really tremendous investments in the priorities of what the state needs to move forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's a public policy document. I mean, it's a spending plan, but that's why I think I think transformational is probably a good word, Kyle, because, you know, for the last 20 years, it's been, you're right, it's reflected the policy priorities of the Republican Party for the most part, and the Democrats are now in control, and so it's a complete shift and transformation about what the public policy around the budget is.
All right, so Matt, this is kind of a different spin on a question I gave Julie earlier, but during the first half of this session, we saw hot button issues like right to work, Elliot Larson's civil rights expansion, the abortion law repeal being addressed. Do you anticipate the same type of contentious issues that we saw in the first half played out again in the second half?
I don't think they're going to go away. I mean, I think that there probably will be continue to be issues. You know, I would say that the Democrats said, what's our A-list? What do we need to get done here first in the first half of the year? And what we're going to see is still some things that have, you know, probably on the environmental front, probably still some more things on the education front that have been contentious in the past, but maybe not rise to quite the level that some of these big A-list items will be. I also think we're moving into an election year. I mean, it seems crazy to think, but we are. And these districts, you know, the redistricting commission love it or hate it, a lot of these districts are a lot closer now than they used to be before. And some of these members are not maybe going to want to go into the election next year with some of these contentious votes. So I think, the conventional wisdom around town was that the Democrats and the governor wanted to get the hard stuff done fast, so that they didn't have to focus on this going into the election year, both in the presidential front, but also for the House, because keeping that House is going to be critical for them if they want to continue this role.
You know what I've been watching is the energy policy debate that's going on. I've found that to be really interesting. And as much as I'm optimistic about bipartisanship, I think that's going to be one to watch. You saw in the House Energy Committee this week, Jerry Norcia was brought in. There's a huge focus on rates, and there's going to be public hearings emphasizing rates in Michigan. And that's really the role of the Public Service Commission. And it just feels like the legislature is really kind of taking an outsized role in energy policy, and it's becoming quite contentious. So I'm going to be watching that.
You're right. That's an interesting thing to bring up, because energy policy has never been a partisan issue. It is there. It's been much more of an ideological issue. And when those big energy bills pass, it's not Republicans versus Democrats. It's utility folks versus everybody else. And it'll be fascinating to see how that plays out with this new leadership in place.
Yeah.
Another issue that isn't necessarily partisan is the aggregates issue, which I know you're extremely familiar with, Matt. I know you've got do you still have a client on that issue?
I'm not so much anymore, but it's still close to my heart. I still think it's a bad bill, but we're not working on it anymore now.
But that's the same kind of thing. That's a contentious yep. issue, but not necessarily a partisan issue.
Exactly. No, you're absolutely right. And I think maybe, I think those kinds of things, those kinds of things happen in the legislature all the time. That's not unique to this session. There are those issues that don't have party lines. And I think we'll probably see those as much as we'll see, contentious stuff around education reform and other things that are more traditionally Republican versus Democrat.
Samantha, go ahead and ask a question here.
I mean, what I'm curious about is, what is the future of the SOAR fund, which is the state legislature's corporate incentive? I'll controversially describe it as a honeypot.
Can I take that, Matt?
I was hoping you would. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, I think, a lot of how these big projects that, that locally have been very, very contentious in places that, they have proposed, these massive plants, and these communities are like, sorry, we don't want it. and it'll be interesting to see how the state will react with these massive amounts of money that they're giving to some of these companies for to build these plants for communities that are said they don't want it. And I'll be honest, this Marshall plant, I was really shocked to find that the plant that's in Marshall, the jobs are paying $18-19 an hour. That doesn't, to me, that doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, these are like $40,000 a year jobs, and it seems like I can see why Marshall's like, you could do better. Like, why? we don't need this. It'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
And there's people in Marshall who are saying, we'd rather have something, outdoor, recreational, natural, as opposed to a mega site.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. It's a question mark of whether, mega site development is today's economic development strategy or yesterday's economic development strategy. I'll be watching this Growing Michigan Together Council that's going to be convening to talk about how to grow our population. And, we're ranked pretty poorly in a lot of indicators that other more prosperous states are better at us than, like educational attainment. And, a college degree attainment is a key factor in determining a state's economic prosperity. And yet most Michigan high school grads aren't meeting college readiness proficiency standards. We know about our reading and math scores. So, I think focusing on talent and education over mega sites might be a way to grow the state.
Be dangerous going into this is Julie's area of expertise, but when you look at the areas of the country that are growing, like the Columbuses, the Indianapolis, and even if you look at Grand Rapids, there people aren't moving there because they're going to get an $18 an hour job at a battery plant. I mean, those are people who are going to pick up and move their families someplace are doing it because that they have a job that's going to give them a good living and a good standard of living. I'm not sure that these mega sites are going to provide that for people who aren't, at the very top of the management team.
You know, Samantha, you just covered the Appropriations Committee on the Senate, where they decided they were going to take that last remaining SOAR fund, which was already approved by the legislature, but they're going to divvy them out into specific grants. So they're not going to do these mega sites like Goshen and the Ford Oval plant. They're going to go ahead and have some kind of competitive bid process, is my understanding. And I think we've got to see how that process works, and if it looks like it's done fairly and it's actually drawing jobs. And if so, I think the legislature would be fine doing more of that. But I think they're content to kind of watch this process play out before stamping the check on more stuff.
I think one thing interesting about that, what the Senate Appropriations Panel approved on Wednesday, is that, traditionally when we think of the SOAR fund, we think of money going to a corporation for one specific project. Instead, this is $250 million that's going to go directly back to the MEDC. And the MEDC, the whole purpose of this multi-million dollar investment is to ramp up Michigan's inventory of shovel-ready sites. And that also includes money for, what we're just talking about, mega sites and large sites.
Yeah, so we'll see how that plays out, if that actually helps the economy and if the Democrats get a stomach to do more of this stuff, because giving money to corporations is not something Democrats are used to doing or campaigning on.
And we're still talking about, the legislature potentially having to adjourn early for the year, as early as September. So I'm curious, are we going to get a end of the year supplemental? Do we even have the money left over to do something like that?
Well, I think we'll find out as they play out here and as we move into the last second half, anyway, of the 2023 session. Well, thank you very much. We're going to put a capper on it. Julie Menny Bennett from the Public Sector Consultants and Matt Resch from Resch Strategies. Appreciate you both for joining us here on the podcast.
Feels like it's been 6 months and 7 days when I'm without you. There ain't no way I don't think about you. All I do is think about you. I love when you get so shy that your cheeks turn red. How am I the only guy inside your head? I'm thinking out loud. Yeah, I'm just thinking out loud. Yeah.
Joining me here live in the MERS World Headquarters is Nick Acapinti from the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. Thanks for joining us in this stormy recording of the MERS Monday podcast.
Hey, Kyle. Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks so much for the invite.
We got the rain falling and the thunder and the lightning in the background, and let's just hope that it's washing all the smoke out of the air.
Yeah, that's right. It's been bad out there.
Oh, it's bad. Yeah. Yeah, I can't even get my bike ride in, which is very sad. Sad for me. Let's talk about the budget, because that's not been very sad for the environmental community or really any of the interest groups that Democrats typically align with. Tell me what in this budget you are most excited about.
Yeah, I think the investments in water were something that we can all be proud of as a state of Michigan, that Michigan LCV fought hard for. Water infrastructure spending kind of leading the way. Also some dollars for water affordability, contaminated site cleanup. So just another strong statement and a bipartisan statement from across the aisle that Michiganders, they love our water and they support it. And when push comes to shove, they look to fund the programs that take care of it.
I know the governor and the legislature had put in like $100 million to replace lead service lines and only ended up with $9 million. Why did that get slighted, do you think?
I'm not sure. When we look at the across the budget at the priorities that were funded, there's so much need and so many great programs that were funded. Those individual decisions we'll have to ask around town to get good detailed information from. I know that it's been expensive to replace lead service lines, as there's a limited amount of labor across the state to do that work, and so the price has been rising over time. The need continues, but there's also a lot of money in the system, so it's something that we'll be back to the well for again to make sure that we pull every lead service line out of the ground eventually, but not sure on this particular decision. But again, I'm pretty darn happy on the water funding side of things in terms of the final product that came out of the budget process.
Yeah, and when I looked at the governor's line as far as a cleaning up contaminated site, it looked like it was lower than the $100 million that she proposed, but could there be some other parts in the budget where if you add it all up, it is what the governor wanted?
Yeah, I think that when you look at the various budget funding pots for contaminated site cleanup, some of the money shows up in PFAS remediation specifically, something like $37 million there. There's some money dedicated to EJ community cleanup that I think will also be allocated to some contaminated site cleanup, as well as that specific traditional funding that goes towards contaminated site cleanup. So when you add the pots up in total, pretty impressed, and I think it's a solid investment in contaminated site cleanup in our state. And you know, as you know, Kyle, there's tens of thousands of sites, some 24,000 if you're counting all the sites that we know of in the state of Michigan that have to be cleaned. So we're just happy that we can address more of those sites more quickly.
Is there a program in particular that you were very excited about seeing that it got funded?
Yeah, again, you know, just the investment in Michigan's water and our water, the water infrastructure allocations are amounting to well over $400 million in total. But there was a piece on water affordability as well that I thought was really, really powerful. So $46 million invested in, you know, folks that are behind on their water bills or in arrears. And what that does is it empowers the policy conversation that's being led right now in Lansing by Senator Stephanie Chang and lots of stakeholders at the table so that we can work towards a policy solution and, you know, in the interim have this funding that both shores up utilities and their bottom line, but then also takes care of the Michiganders that are behind on those bills. So a win-win opportunity there that sets up a great policy conversation.
Another policy conversation that will be hot, I think, in the summer is this discussion about renewable portfolio standards and in getting to carbon-free electricity. Talk about the goal that you would like to see in the environmental community is kind of rallied around.
Yeah. There's a bicameral set of bills that have been introduced, so both the House and the Senate side, and there's three core bills that are at the heart of each that we're very excited about, and that's the Renewable Energy Standard, the Energy Efficiency or Energy Waste Reduction Standard, and the called PSC Empowerment. It really gives authority to the Michigan Public Service Commission to address rates, equity, and climate emissions, all in the purview of the Michigan Public Service Commission. So those three bills are at the center of our A, climate change action, but B, really looking at driving down rates for Michiganders. There's an exciting moment that we're facing, Kyle, here in Michigan with the Inflation Reduction Act having passed the federal level. A whole ton of money is about to flow in the state of Michigan, and getting the policy apparatus right so that we can turn those spigots and let the money start flowing. It's just a really great opportunity to take action on climate and to drive economic development in the state of Michigan around a clean energy future. So those three bills on, you know, in each chamber are at the core of that discussion.
All right. Well, let's talk about the one about setting goals as to when we want to move toward a clean energy. And the goal is to go carbon free by 2035. Is that right?
Yes, the goal is to be 100% carbon-free by 2035. There is a 60% renewable energy standard by 2030, but carbon-free is that broader, more flexible standard.
And that would include, does that include hydro and nuclear or just nuclear?
Yeah, it does include both on the okay. carbon-free side. And, you know, indeed, I think there's going to be a robust conversation about what's in, what's out. And the bill sponsors and committee chairs have set out this summer to really have those conversations and to get down to the details of what such a standard would include.
Do you like nuclear energy? Does that need to be part of the mix?
Yeah, so Michigan LCV as an organization does not support the addition of new nuclear energy. And that's something that, you know, we've held for a while. I do think when you look at the overall mix and there's a robust discussion that, you know, it's very possible that things like nuclear emerge. And of course, under our proposal, that extra 40% does allow for nuclear energy to be a part of the system.
What about biomass?
Yeah, so biomass, as the bills are currently proposed, are grandfathered in the current activities. But going forward into the future, that would not be considered a renewable energy.
Describe what biomass is for our listeners who may not be familiar with it.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not the expert on biomass, but in general, it's the burning of various wood and fiber stocks for the production of energy.
And you all aren't a big fan of it just because it kind of pollutes the air?
Well, yeah, there's all sorts of data on, you know, whether or not it's technically kind of carbon free. So there's questions around that. But when you look at how we really think of the core renewables, those are the cleanest, the most healthy and efficient for Michiganders, those that are guaranteed to drive down climate emissions. You know, biomass is not on the top of our list. But that type of conversation, again, you know, the sponsors will be hosting over the summer. We'll have lots of good, robust policy talks. And, you know, anybody's guess at the moment what's in and what's not, but it would not be on the top of our list for what's considered a renewable energy resource.
I remember a few years ago when we had Senate and House Democrats, and at the time they obviously weren't in the majority, so they didn't have to necessarily be held accountable to this, but they were looking at getting carbon free by 2050. So what has changed in just the last 4 years that we're able to ratchet down our expectations and what we want to see as far as clean energy so drastically by 15 years?
Yeah, it's a great question, and everything's changed in a sense. And well, I'm going to start again with the Inflation Reduction Act, just the amount of money that is going to flow into Michigan. Let me give you some examples here. So just on the home energy efficiency side of things, you know, energy efficiency isn't sexy, but it is to me because it's the cleanest, cheapest, and most quickly deployed source of energy available for all Michiganders. But again, just on the energy efficiency and electrification side, from the federal government, Michigan has been allocated $211 million. That's one opportunity, one piece in front of us. There is a program dedicated to low-income communities and households that's $7 billion for community solar and rooftop solar. That's a competitive grant program. I mentioned we've got to set the policy framework to ensure that this federal money flows into Michigan and the Michigan homes and business can capture it. You don't need to look farther than that competitive grant program for the state. $7 billion nationwide. We've got to fight to win that money. And, you know, I think it's an incredible opportunity. I can go down the list. That's just the beginning. The production tax credit, of course, for utility scale solar and wind continues. The in-home tax credits, the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund on its own, $27 billion with a B, for states to identify overburdened communities by pollution and invest technical assistance in helping those communities apply for resources and ultimately invest in clean and renewable energy.
So what you're saying is there's so many programs out there that if we can just get in front of them and bring it in, we're going to go ahead and we're going to meet these goals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's what the legislation is positioned to do. It's going to drive economic development, good paying jobs that don't necessarily require a college degree. There's a whole lot of upside to this. And, you know, some folks have said, well, you know, can you really get this done in time? Is this possible? Mm-hmm. You know, Kyle, I would never bet against the people of Michigan, our businesses and our industries to get it done. But more importantly than that, we're going to model all this. It's going to work through the traditional standard IRP planning process. That's an acronym your listeners are probably familiar with, Integrated Resource Planning at the Michigan Public Service Commission, the standard modeling. And we're going to do it in a way that is economically and technologically feasible and that drives down costs.
This past week, we heard from Jerry Norcia from DTE, and he was talking about all the work that they're doing to get Michigan to bring in more renewables. And, of course, Consumers has talked how they're among the leaders in the country in switching toward renewables. Do you give them props for the work that they're doing on that front?
You know, I think Consumers Energy in particular has made a lot of progress. Their previous IRP, Michigan LCV, was I'm happy to celebrate as historic in our kind of public reaction to it, bringing more than 8 gigawatts of solar power online. DTE has made a similar process in its IRP that's before the Public Service Commission right now, but still has to be settled. So now it's delivering on those promises that is the great work of the next 5, 10, 15 years. And doing so in a manner that, again, drives down rates and is affordable for Michiganders. And we've got to accelerate that build out a little bit. We're not on the pace that we need to be to number one, match the science to take action on climate. But two, to do in a way that saves Michiganders money. And I know this is probably new for some of your listeners, but when we look at the levelized cost of energy from the Michigan Public Service Commission, you just can't compete with renewables anymore. Coal, you know, even natural gas, renewable energy is cheaper, and nothing comes close to energy efficiency. By far, the cleanest, cheapest, and most quickly deployed source of energy for Michiganders. And Kyle, I know you want some data to back that up, and I have some for you here.
Okay, good.
Yep, so according to the 2022 Renewable Energy Standard Report by the Michigan Public Service Commission, so this is fresh, the levelized cost of energy from coal is $133 per megawatt hour, $64 per megawatt hour for renewable energy, $68 for natural gas, and then energy efficiency, which I'm always saying energy efficiency's praises, not as exciting to folks, but $26 per megawatt hour. We cannot do enough energy efficiency for Michigan's homes and businesses quickly enough.
Energy efficiency, that's basically making sure people are hooked up with better washing machines and dishwashers and furnaces, correct?
That's just the surface. We're just scratching the surface on energy efficiency. We need to go deep into energy retrofits, deep into the home, into the thermal envelope. Kind of a wonky idea for insulation. You got to be insulating the building, its walls, its crawl spaces. Most of the energy in a building, the thermal energy is lost through the attic. And through, you know, folks go right to the windows. But, you know, because it's a beautiful aesthetic improvement to a home.
And you feel the draft?
And you feel the draft. It's more obvious. It's not where the best bang for your buck is. You need to get your homes insulated. You know, I'm reminded of the polar vortex a few years ago that really caused the state some problems when it took out a consumer's energy power production plan. And during that storm, it was very windy. And Kyle, I'm a renter, and my unit's older. It's in the city of Grand Rapids. That storm just blew right through my home. It was sucking the warm air, you know, out of my apartment like wild. And I recognize that was something that needed to be addressed, because that was money getting pulled out the windows, pulled out the doors, pulled out of the spaces and the crevices in my home.
And you and I'm not going to debate here the energy efficient or the cheaper energy is renewable, but you still have to build that renewable energy. And I think that's one of the arguments, that if you go too quickly, it's going to be more expensive, because you got to find a place to put these solar farms, and you know, the land isn't free, and neither are these solar panels, and neither are the windmills that you're sticking up in these farmlands.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up how difficult it is to site renewable energy at the moment. We know that it's a real issue, it's a critical issue, and it's something that we're going to have to work on. We want communities to welcome in these projects. We want locals to be happy, not only the private property owner that puts renewable energy on their property and benefits from it, but their neighbors and the folks around them. And we think we can do that in a couple of ways. One, they've got to know about the opportunity that's headed their way from the federal government and the Inflation Reduction Act. But two, you know, I think developers, including our own major utilities, need to do a much better job working with local communities, in particular with the wind rollout. There was a situation that was set up that maybe wasn't incredibly fair from the local unit of government's perspective, where money was clawed back after an agreement was made on the revenue that would flow into those communities, in particular money that, you know, would be headed to important critical services such as schools. And so we want to set up a situation where that doesn't happen again, where the benefits, the revenue is well known to the communities, and no money is being clawed back through the legal process, where, again, benefits are shared. But I got one more fact here to kind of draw narrative to the point that you made and how important it is to have a good siting structure that allows us to get this built. So if there were no constraints, and we pulled this from DTE's own IRP analysis right now, if there were no constraints on siting and building out the renewable energy future, we would save ratepayers $1.3 billion. But because of the difficulty they anticipate in siting renewable energy around the state of Michigan, they're going to have to make that $1.3 billion interim investment in natural gas, which is going to raise costs. And so that's the kicker. Not only is it expensive to site that renewable energy because of the difficulties in working with local communities and building it out at the moment, but it's because that expense comes from the higher cost of natural gas in the interim before those renewable energy facilities can come online at the lower cost.
Nick, I can hear somebody telling me right now that you're talking about moving away from coal-burning energy and natural gas. But what's making the air unbreathable right now is forest fires from Canada, which has nothing to do with coal. It has nothing to do with natural gas.
Yeah. Well, of course, this is why we're doing all of this from a conservation perspective, is to forestall the worst impacts of climate change. Now, we know the impacts are already here. I drove an I-96 to get here this morning, Kyle, and it was unbelievable. It was worse than Delhi, India. I've got a good buddy that lives in Delhi, India, and had my first chance to visit him this past Christmas. He's been there for 10 years with his family. And we watched the air quality there in that city, and known for its poor air quality every day. And it's worse here. And those forest fires in the boreal forest of Canada are no doubt being driven by climate change. Scientists have already spoken up. Julia Cole from the University of Michigan penned an op-ed on this. The science is clear. The drier, hotter conditions are driving those forest fires, which are driving poor air quality. And of course, that poor air quality is sitting on top of the combustion of fossil fuels in communities across Michigan that just makes it worse. And I do want to make a really specific point about the health impacts here. I think your listeners will be comfortable and familiar with the cardiovascular and pulmonary effects of breathing polluted air. But you know what's less known is just how bad the pollution drives dementia. So more and more studies are coming out to show the connection directly with air pollution and dementia. So I'm going to cite one study here from the Harvard School of Public Health. It's an April 2023 study, so this is a fresh study. More than 57 million people worldwide are currently living with dementia. Up to 40% of those cases can be attributed to modifiable risks such as air pollutants. But more, they went further in this study. Within the study, the researchers found a 17% increase in a risk for developing dementia for every 2 micrograms per cubic meter in increase in exposure to PM2.5. So PM2.5 is what's out there right now. It's particulate matter. It's the little stuff in the air. And so with every incremental increase in air pollution, the increase in dementia has been associated with it. So just an incredible impact on brain, heart, and lungs.
We could go on and on, but we're running out of time right now. I appreciate you coming in. Nick Acapinti from the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. Thanks so much for joining us here on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you, Kyle. I had fun and look forward to it again in the future.
Joining us now on the podcast is Tim Ward, and you might know him as the president of Michigan Legislative Consultants. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
One of your hobbies that you're passionate about is a passion I also share, road biking, particularly in the summertime. And it sounds like you've got an ambitious goal that you're going to be undertaking, and I was hoping you could share that here with our listeners.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I enjoy our biking conversations over the years and just kind of catching up on what your recent ventures have been. And I do have one coming up on July 10th. We're calling it Trace Michigan. It's a supported ride, meaning I'll have a SAG crew, a support and gear crew. We'll be living out of an RV, and I'll be traveling 2,400 miles, tracing the 2 peninsulas of the state. Doing that 2,400 miles over just 22 days of riding. It's as a fundraiser for a nonprofit client of ours, Chance for Life, and also to raise awareness. The organization has been doing great work for a couple decades, and not a lot of people know about it. And so we're gonna seek to change that.
Wow. So let's talk about the ride itself first, because I find this the most fascinating. 2,400 miles, and you're going to go around the coast or along the coast of Michigan, mm-hmm. the Lower Peninsula and the Upper Peninsula. I've never heard of this before.
Yeah, I did a little research after I came up with the idea, and you know, because I'd love to learn from somebody else who's done it. I haven't found that it's been done. You know, maybe somebody's done it, but it's just not out there. But yeah, we're going to start in Detroit and going counterclockwise, heading north, Just tracing the two peninsulas, and I figure it'll be one phenomenal way to see a lot of the state that I haven't seen before, and it's doing it on a bike is a great way to see even areas where I've lived, and because your pace is so much slower, that you notice things that you've never noticed before. So I'm really looking forward to doing it.
About 100 a day, you think?
Yeah, it varies. There's 2 days where it'll be below 100, about 90. And then the rest of the days are between 100 and 124 miles. It varies just based on the segment, based on the stage.
And when you get to Mackinac City, then are you going to go over the bridge and then do the Upper Peninsula at that point?
Yes. Yep. We'll just traverse the bridge in the RV, and then heading out of St. Ignace, maintain the counterclockwise direction, and then find our way up to the Sioux, and then across across Lake Superior, and we'll have stops at different locations. One of our stops will be at Northern Michigan University. We've been representing them for a number of years, and so we happen to end up in Marquette, and so we're going to do a stop there on the campus.
Wow. And are you going to go all the way up the Keweenaw Peninsula then?
Yeah, actually one day we conclude in Houghton, and then the next day is just going up to Copper Harbor and coming back to Houghton. It's it doesn't look like it's much on the map, but the miles add up quickly. It's just out and back from Houghton. So it'll be a true tracing of the peninsula.
Wow. And then once you get to, I presume you're going to get to Ironwood then at some point?
I'm actually going to go through the Porcupine Mountains. I was there as a kid. I forgot how little I was, but I remember walking through the Porcupine Mountains with my dad. We were camping up there, and my dad and one of my sisters, and my dad actually had to like skip over a porcupine as we were walking through the mountains. So hopefully, since I'll be on the road going through the mountains, I won't run into any porcupines.
So this is an amazing undertaking that you're engaging in. How did this come about?
Well, I've been cycling for, I think this is my seventh year, and I've been working with a cycling coach for six. So I do a lot of cycling through all four seasons. In the wintertime, my bikes are on a trainer, and this time of year, I'm cycling 7 days a week. In the off season, I cycle 5 days a week, and I do 2 days a week of off bike workouts. So now my training for this has gotten a little different in terms of the preparation, but I have a coach, Chris Fisher of Fisher Training Systems, and years ago he used to be a professional racer over in Europe, and so he knows this stuff. So but in terms of how did this particular event come about, I was out on one of my training rides quite a while back, and I kind of played that, how could I use my passion for cycling to benefit someone else other than just my own benefit? And we represent Chance for Life. And I thought of Tom Adams, the president of the organization. He's just such a positive person. I mean, I've been working with him a number of years, and every conversation we have, you start off, hey, how's it going? And his answer is the same every time. Absolutely spectacular. And he's got his own business, but he's been passionate about Chance for Life for over 20 years, and largely been funding it himself. And so I thought, well, this is Tom and Chance for Life are just the people in the organization to use my passion for and help Tom in his passion.
Tell our listeners what Chance for Life is.
Chance for Life has been in Michigan prisons for a couple decades. It's actually in 1999, they implemented the first transformation project at Mound Correctional Facility. There were 25 inmates who were leaders of diverse religions and other prison-based organizations, and they were selected to participate in Chance for Life's long-term training program that consisted of mediation and other communication skills. And they were taught and they learned how to resolve their disputes using mediation skills, and then also how to train other inmates. And within 1 year, the mediation, because of those mediation skills, the Mound facility saw a 40% decrease in violent incidents among the inmates. At its core, it just transforms how incarcerated persons think and how they act.
And they do it by working with the leaders of particular groups within the prison, right?
Yeah, they do. When they go in addition to Tom, and then Jessica Taylor is the executive director, and she's the one that's actually trained and certified in mediation and conflict resolution. They'll go into a prison, and when they go in there for the first time, they sit down with the gang leaders, and they have to get their buy-in because the gang leaders run the prisons. And once they get their buy-in, then the rest of the prison population, it's acceptable for them to follow as well. And so they'll get, Aryan Nation, Nation of Islam, the Latino gangs, and they'll get their buy-in, and then they can then move forward. And so they put on these classes. Tom and Jessica drive 6 days a week. They're ramping back up post-pandemic, but pre-pandemic, the two of them would drive to different prisons around the state six evenings a week, and they would, they train a certain group of the prisoners, and then when they're not there, then those prisoners can, those inmates can then teach other inmates in classes when Tom and Jessica are not there.
Why would the gang leaders buy into this? Because many of them are lifers. They're not getting out anyway, so what difference does it make if they have a more positive atmosphere in the prison?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great question, Kyle. To the colonel, we'd have to ask them, but what I witnessed when I went in and saw it in the prison, it gives them a better way of thinking. It gives them a purpose, because, inmates behind bars that are never leaving, what motivates them each day, what gives them purpose each day, and the authenticity and the accountability that they took for their own actions that put them there was really remarkable. And so it just changed who they are, and they like who they are now. Like you said, even if they're not getting out, it gives them a purpose. They get to help other inmates. And just because somebody's, was a bad guy and is serving time for doing bad things, doesn't mean that there isn't room for redemption and to help others.
So how long is this bike adventure that you're looking at going to take? And are you concerned about any lingering Canadian wildfire smoke?
Yeah, it's it starts July 10th, and I'll conclude on August 3rd back in Detroit. And so I'll ride 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. I'll rest on Sunday. Hopefully that rest will help prevent injury, or if I have run into a mechanical problem or whatever and don't get in the mileage that I need to, then I can use that as a little bit of a catch-up day so we can stay on track. And yeah, the Canadian wildfires is something to be concerned with, but there's nothing that I can do about it. So actually between now and July 10th, I'm actually going to give a practice ride or two with a KN95 mask and see how that works, because if it's necessary in order to keep going, then I'll need to put something like that on. But hopefully I won't. Hopefully the winds will become favorable. And then also hopefully once I get farther up into the western side of the state, both in the UP and the lower peninsula, it seems to have been lighter over there than it is in the middle of the state or over here on the east side.
Well, it sounds like a heck of a venture. Is there a particular goal that you're hoping to reach as far as fundraising here?
No, we don't have a magic number in mind. Kind of like politics, it's never enough. Same thing in the nonprofit world. So it's both money and also awareness. that that we're going for here. So we really have two goals. And we've had gala dinners, one last year and then one pre-pandemic. But what's a little different with this one is there's going to be the ability for people to make online contributions. One, to follow this ride, Trace Michigan. We're going to be on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and the Trace MI ride. Listeners can search on that and on all those platforms and come up with the pages there and follow us. And then there's also going to be, before we launch, a connection where if people want to make a contribution, $5, $10, whatever people can afford to support Chance for Life, we would welcome that support, along with, you know, any messaging along the way, words of encouragement. And we're also going to be taking photos along the way, and it'll give people a chance to see maybe some parts of Michigan they haven't seen before. So also looking forward to posting our travel as well and having a lot of fun with it.
Well, I just looked it up myself, went to Facebook and just did a search for Trace MI Ride, and there it is. The page is all ready to go. So I'm going to go ahead and follow it now myself so I can see how things go. And let's keep in touch.
Appreciate it.
And yeah, maybe I'll ride a day or something with you.
I would love to do that, Kyle. Hold me to that.
Excellent. Tim Ward, he is with Michigan Legislative Consultants. Appreciate you sharing this extremely impressive endeavor here with us.
Thanks for having me, Kyle. I appreciate it.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to all of our guests this week: Julie Meddy Bennett from Public Sector Consultants, Matt Resch from Resch Strategies, Nick Acapinti from the Michigan League of Conservation Voters, and of course, Tim Ward, who we just talked to, from Michigan Legislative Consultants. Post-production of the MERS Money Podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Also, AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen for Samantha Schreiber, who will be filling in for me the next couple weeks. Have a great 4th of July weekend, and we'll catch you later. I want to ride.